Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest today is Noel Paul Stuckey. Yes, Paul of Peter, Paul, and Mary. Noel, how you doing?
I'm good. Paul. I heard Paul. So, like, you must be an East Coast kind of guy.
You know, it's funny. I'm from Connecticut, and people from Connecticut think that they don't have an accent, but you've just proven that that's untrue.
Well, I used to be mid-East Coast. I was born in Maryland, born in Baltimore, lived in Maryland for quite a few years before moving to the Midwest. But when you move to the Midwest, they say most disc jockeys and radio people come from the Midwest because they lose their accent. And to a large extent, I think that's true. I don't hear that I have an accent, except if I have to pronounce the word M-I-L-K. Peter used to rag me all the time because I'd say, I'll take a glass of milk. He said,
exactly. There's an E in there that we don't have on the East Coast.
Yeah, that's right.
I spent a summer in Chicago in 69, which makes me an antique, but they called soda pop, which was a new thing for me.
Yeah.
Okay. You're in.
Egg creams were a new thing to me when I moved to New York. I mean, I
that's very that. Much a New York thing. I mean, I had heard about them. But I grew up in Connecticut, 50 miles from New York, and you certainly just couldn't run around and get an egg cream in Fairfield, Connecticut, or Bridgeport right next to it.
No.
But right now you're in Maine?
I am. I'm on the coast, a beautiful little town that I am reluctant to give you the title of because many people will want to move here and obscure the quaintness of the village. But yeah, I live in Blue Hill, Maine. I have for the past 47 years with my wife, Betty, of 57 years, and we brought our three children up here, followed a Back to the Earth movement, really, in the late 60s, early 70s.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which on top
after
of
we were licking our wounds after the Vietnam War protests.
Yeah, yes. Well, the desire, I think, of every human heart is to get to the essence of what life is all about. And it's hard to do that when you're being shaken around in New York City. So we were very happy to move here. Life was simpler. We had to abandon some of the niceties, but then we found, you know, deeper niceties. And it's been, and of course, you know, pandemic notwithstanding, it's been very easy to travel. Most of my work was on a stage. If it wasn't in Ohio, it was in San Francisco or Utah or Chicago. So it didn't really make any difference where my home base was.
Okay. How far from Boston are you?
5-hour drive, maybe.
Okay. So what's the nearest main city?
Oh, Bangor. That's where the airport is.
Oh, you're way up there. I've been to Bangor.
Oh, you have? Why?
Yeah, I went on a canoe trip on the Allagash once again. That was 68, but we flew to Bangor, and then you had to take like a four-hour bus ride. People have no idea how large Maine really is.
That's true. That's true. You get to go far north. But boy, it is beautiful. You know, there are, a million people in the whole state? And I would say fully a quarter of them living in the Portland area. So I think that accounts for the reason that people are so friendly to one another, because there's so few of us. We're so happy to see each other. Oh my gosh, another human being. It's great. And yes, you're right. We are really up here. It's almost in what you'd consider down east.
Okay. So the water never gets warm where you are.
Not really. No.
Okay. And how many people are in the town of Blue Hill?
Oh, about 2,500. In the summertime, it swells to maybe 3,500.
Okay, so at least a decent number. You're not there twiddling your fingers alone. So you say you've been married for 57 years.
Isn't
and
that something?
Also, you've lived your life to a great degree on the road. The combination doesn't always work.
You
so
got
what
that
is,
right.
What is the secret to success?
Well, it's a combination of friendship. Now, that may sound lightweight when you're trying to describe a marriage relationship. But the fact is, Betty and I went to high school together in Michigan. And though we never dated then, We knew of each other for various reasons. She was a knockout dream queen cheerleader and a year behind me. And I was the local rock and roll kid with my own rhythm and blues band in high school. And we met, get this, Bob, in the distance we'll hear a drum roll. We met by chance coming out of a subway in New York City some 8 years later. And I said, Betty Banner? And she said, Noel Stuckey? And her date said, you know, we really got to get moving along. And I said, that's all right. I'll walk with you to the wherever you're going. So that began a relationship. But the challenges of being on the road and maintaining a relationship were many. And I wasn't always equal to the task. The first 10 years were filled with so much success and so much work. I mean, honestly, we did 300 shows a year, 300 shows in 1 year. And that's, you know, we're trying to shoehorn in record albums, television appearances, publicity, travel itself, you know, a half day to get there and a half day to get back. So a remarkable wife who has raised now three daughters with me, you can understand why we would want to get out of the city and simplify our life. And frankly, if it hadn't been for a deep longing to know who I was and what this thing called living was all about, I wouldn't have taken the spiritual turn that I took in the late 60s, which really changed my life, gave me a whole perspective on what really has value. You know, other human beings, and also a desire to be authentic. Now, I grew up as an only child, so I could be authentic to myself, but what did it mean to be authentic to the world? Does that mean telling the truth all the time? Well, passing through the gate of marijuana, one can be overly authentic with people, and I tended to be a little excessive the first say 10, 12 years of my life. But ultimately, I have been very blessed to discover the language of metaphor, which is what songwriting is all about, and realize that everybody has a spiritual sense. They just need to be acquainted with it. You know, the atheist who denies God really is very hard-pressed to deny love. And yet, if you read the Bible, you see that Paul says that God is love. And if you interact normally in your life, you begin to recognize the value of love in your own life, whether it's interpersonal or whether it's kind of faith that tomorrow will be a better time. So all of those things factored into how I've been able to enjoy this marriage with this beautiful woman that I married, still enjoy companionship with my children. There's a lot of humor, a lot of laughter. Some of it is hard pressed. Some of it, particularly in these contested times in which we live, where we're taught by our leaders to mistrust that which we read, and we end up carrying that over into a mistrust of each other or a cynicism. It's more of a challenge than it used to be. But at the core of it, Bob, I swear, if you can retain your compassion for your fellow human beings, for your fellow citizens, you can make a go of it. You can turn lemons into lemonade, and you can create hope where there has been fear and distrust.
Okay, let's talk about this spiritual, you can't see the air quotes on the podcast, conversion. This is not uncommon with musical artists, traveling people, where almost, you know, they're partaking of substances, and all of a sudden they find themselves on the floor and they have a transformative moment. Was that how it happened to you, or was it an evolution? How did the light go on?
You know, I think, once again, if I can refer to being an only child, there's an inner dialogue going on all the time, because I didn't have brothers or sisters to have that dialogue with. So there's a refutation, a kind of a distrust that's built into the character of an only child, because he doesn't really know what's dependable. And so this whole barrel of fame and fortune that landed on me in 1960 was increasingly more difficult to figure out personal worth from. If I was standing in line with Betty waiting to go into a movie and the manager saw and recognized me, he'd say, oh, Mr. Stuckey, come on. You don't have to wait. You start to take those, or Mr. Stuckey, we have a table. I don't have a reservation. It's okay. We have a table for you. Oh, Mr. Stuckey, come here. You begin to believe your own press clippings. And that becomes a very empty, hollow existence, because you have to make a choice. You are either going to start believing it and buying into it, or if you're trying to be real, you're going to stick with people who are truth tellers, like my wife, or that little piece of conscience that you hung on to since you were a little kid that told you it was bad to take that piece of candy from the five and dime. And you say, okay, well, it's bad to borrow on other people's awarenesses. I just want to be a citizen. So it wasn't really a drug problem that brought me to my knees. It was more of a soul problem. I just really needed to know if there was some direction in life that was valuable with a capital V. And, you know, I don't know if you want to hear the whole story, but I was backstage in Austin, in Abilene, Texas, and a kid, and I'm going through these changes. You know, I'm asking myself, what's life all about? My God, you know, I want to be on the right side. I want to be on the good side. Now, parenthetically, I have to insert here something that you already know. When you're out in the world and there's a chance to do good, whether it's feeding or housing the homeless, or whether it's protesting the war in Vietnam, or whether it's marching for human rights, there is a sense of participation in something that's bigger than yourself and something that's good. So notwithstanding those kind of encouragements, one asks oneself, well, okay, but these are just actions. I want to be connected with these actions. I want to have a sense of familial participation in the betterment of the world. Where do I find that? So, flashback to Abilene, Texas. This kid comes up to me backstage. There's nobody around. You know, security is pretty good at concerts, and usually people don't, you know, are not allowed backstage. So I'm back there tuning the guitar, and there's this kid standing there, and he says, can I talk to you? I say, well, yeah, I'll look for you after. Okay, I'm a little busy right now. But as those things go, and one tries to be true to one's word, when the show was over, I tried to look for him, and sure enough, there he was. So in the midst of a bunch of people, maybe a half dozen of them handing me albums to sign and pictures and telling me about the last time that they saw the trio, I turn to the kid and say, what was it you wanted to talk to me about? And he says, I want to talk to you about the Lord. And the bottom dropped out of reality. And I go, okay. Well, hang on just a second. But my heart is going cha-boom, 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 because it's like an answer to prayer. You know, where did this guy come from, and what gives him the audacious right to say that he wants to talk to me about the Lord? So we get, so the crowd clears out, and he says, I think we should go someplace where we can talk. I say, well, sure. Well, let's go back to my hotel room. Heart's still going bum, 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 bum. But now I'm beginning to think, hey, I'm a star here, okay? I got a reputation. I've got knowledge of the world. I've smoked dope. I've read Edgar Casey. I understand the complexity of things. So as we climb into the back of his pickup truck, his friends are driving, I turn to him and I say, so what do you think about reincarnation? You know, trying to level out the balance of our spiritual experiences. And he says, well, it may or may not be true, but I think we have more important things to talk about tonight, don't you? So we go back to the hotel room and I'm fussing all around. I'm, you know, would you like a Coke? Do you want me to open the window? Anything but confront what it is this kid's possibly going to say. And he says, I think we should pray. And at that moment, he hits the floor on his knees. His friends hit the floor on their knees. And so I do too. And all he said, Bob, was, I think Noel wants to say, or thank you, Lord, for getting me backstage without, into the concert without a ticket, backstage without a pass. And I think Noel wants to talk to you. Pew. And I just started to cry. Because in that moment, I realized how disenfranchised I was from the core of belief. And that was the transformative moment for me. After that, I can't say that, you know, I moved as beatifically as St. Francis. I was really kind of a bore, and I was antagonistic. I was aggressive. I was a Jesus freak. For about 2 years before I learned the language or readopted the language of metaphor and could speak about my faith and what had happened to me in terms that other people could understand, maybe even sympathize with, maybe even emulate. But when you use labels to describe your situation, you're adopting somebody else's descriptions. And they don't always sit well. They're not personalized. So over these past, 40 years or so, 40 to 50 years, I've learned the language of inclusiveness in terms of expressing my faith. So the transformation didn't stop. In 1969, 1970, it began in 1969, 1970, and I'm still going through. Matter of fact, I had this. You want to? Can I do a little song for you?
Well, the only issue is a rights issue. Who wrote the song?
Okay, well, we're covered. There's this guy named Stukey that used to sing with Peter, Paul, and Mary. He wrote the song.
Okay, and you own the song?
And I own the song. Out now.
Okay, then you can sing. Just say you're giving us permission.
Okay, I'm giving you permission. But I'm wondering if maybe, yeah, so I'll just do a little bit of it, but you'll get the idea. So let's talk about love. With a capital L. When was the last time you heard it spelled? With the emphasis in the proper place. Ooh, yeah, let's talk about love in the uppercase. Some might call it amazing grace, or the author of time and space. Let's talk about love, 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 love. You may recall a situation. Change a heart you hadn't seen. Where love's the only explanation for a miracle that sets somebody free. Ooh, yeah, let's talk about love. With a capital L. Not talking about witchcraft or a magic spell or hanky panky in a cheap motel. No, let's talk love, 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 love. I'm not saying that I love you any more or any less. I'm just saying that there's more here than we are usually willing to confess. Let's talk about love, where it all began. Yeah, love, love, love like a master plan. If you believe, then raise your hand. And let's talk about love, 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 love with a capital L.
Woo! So how we, that's for a couple of things. A, how old is that song?
6 months, maybe.
Wow, you still got it. Secondly, you still have your voice when many people, you know, they get older and their voice subsides. Any special trick or just, you know, God helped you out there?
Oh, that's a nice way to put the question. Doubtless, there's some assistance from, you know, having faith. I haven't smoked since August 14th, 1970. And you may ask why I remember that date so specifically. I was driving with a friend, Jim Mason, who produced a couple of Poco albums. And there was a cigarette lighter hole, but no cigarette lighter in the rental car that he was driving. And we both had cigarettes. And I took that as a sign. So I reached over, took the cigarette out of his mouth, out of my mouth, threw it out the window, and I said, August 14th, 1970, the day Noel Stuckey and Jim Mason stopped smoking. Well, unfortunately, it was true for me, but you know, you can't make truth for somebody else. He went back to it, eventually quit. But so I think not smoking has helped a lot. I still drink a fair amount. I mean, I like to have a margarita in the evening and maybe a glass of wine with dinner. My wife certainly keeps me on the straight and narrow in terms of nutrition, you know, lots of veggies and I'm living in the country, Bob. I mean, it's laid back here. And if the pandemic didn't lay me back any further, I'd be lying in bed, but, it's very comfortable and very inspiring to be here.
Okay. Speaking of inspiration. We live in an era very different from the one you came up in.
Woof.
You came up, it was a monoculture. If you were successful, everybody knew your name. Whereas today, it's really a cornucopia of stuff. So how do you keep your inspiration to create?
Well, I've always been, you know, I have to confess that I'm not a writer who writes for remuneration. That's why folk music was so great for me, because it's an institution that that depends on people articulating concerns of the day. They don't write for money. They write because it had to be said. So I really am a cathartic writer. That is to say, I don't sit down like a Burt Bacharach and generate music every day because it's a discipline that I feel I have to obey. I really respond to the particular moment or the particular concern. I mean, when I did Impeachable to the tune of Unforgettable that went viral on YouTube and Facebook, I was responding to what I felt were flagrant offenses by Donald Trump, and I thought that they would be traceable to Russia. That investigation went by the by when Mueller was removed from the opportunity to take it to its finality, along with Comey. And then I wrote a song called "I Will Stand." You know, that opened, the election is over. Some say what's done is done. Well, it's easier if your side has won. So why don't we just work together? And I said, well, there are a list of things that I'm not going to work together on. And I sang a song with about 9 of them. And there's also reinforcement, you know, for instance, if I was creating totally in a vacuum, I'd probably have a more difficult time sustaining it. But when you go in front of anywhere from 15 to 1500 people, and you make a statement musically, you're going to find out pretty quickly if the audience agrees with it. Now, they may, one, think it's entertaining, in which case the applause will be light and smattering. Or they may think that it's moving, in which case you will get a very pronounced, heavy applause at the end of it, like I sometimes do for the 2 new verses I wrote to America the Beautiful. Or sometimes you will get a response that you just hadn't planned on, like people standing up in the middle of what you're singing about, or cheering in the middle of a verse because they agree so strongly with what's being said and the manner in which it's being said. So those encouragements keep me going. But to return to your original question, I basically write in response to that which I see needs articulation.
Okay, one has to ask, since you're talking about politics, you're talking about today's world, I must ask, as a resident of Maine, why did Susan Collins get reelected?
Well, aside from all the impressive monies that were spent to degrade her opponent, because actually there's two sides to that street. There was a lot of impressive monies that were spent to degrade Susan Collins. Essentially, the reasoning behind the deposition of Susan Collins was that she was Trump's lapdog, that anything Trump wanted, she voted for. Well, Maine is not a totally liberal state. I mean, I can't speak for the natives, but they're all straight shooters as far as I'm concerned. You know, they're really honest, God-fearing, if you work hard. I mean, they're the American ethic underlined. And Susan Collins has been there for most of them, most of the time. And like I was telling your engineer before, a lot of Trump's success is not because of who he is, but the fact that people who voted for him are single-issue voters. And the people that voted for Susan Collins were single issue. You know, they wanted to support somebody who is more anti-abortion than she is pro-life, or pro-choice. They wanted to support somebody that they knew, particularly in this cacophony of political chaos that was echoing all around us. And like I said, the issues were pretty angrily ignored so that character assassination could take place. And she had more bucks. And I think she made her point about Gideon's family to the point where, you know, people bought into it. Well, and then I don't want to go someplace that I don't know about. I'm going to stick with Susan. But I had a bumper. I had a bumper sticker on the back of my truck that said "Bye Bye Susan." That was a big popular sign.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. So, what did your parents do for a living? You were an only child.
Yeah, my dad was a mechanical engineer with very clever. He is a very clever, hands-on kind of guy. He worked for the Gates Rubber Company during the war years. And then had a couple of promotions that took us to Michigan, one, and then to Pennsylvania, where living 90 miles from New York City just made me thirsty to move to the city eventually in 1959. My mom was she was a cashier at a restaurant where my dad used to go and play the pinball machine, and he would come up to her and ask her for change. And she would hand him a bunch of nickels, and he became known as Nick. That was his nickname. She came from the St. Aubrey family, had a uncle, I think, who designed Joliet Prison, the architecture for Joliet Prison. She was a very gracious, lovely, lovely woman, spiritual in her own way, former Catholic. Dad was a former Mormon. But they both had to leave their religions to get married. For Dad, it was a second marriage. And they brought me up in the country in a little town called Dorsey, Maryland, about halfway between Baltimore and Washington. And that was a great experience for me. I mean, we farmed with a horse, pulling a plow. I had woods out behind and a lake up on top of a mountain, and a handful of friends. And I say that in a positive way. I had five of the closest buddies you could ever want. We did everything together. Explored together, played games together, imagined together. I even had a circus in my garage where I put the cat under an orange crate and dragged her around in a wagon. And my friends were, you know, the strong man. My friends were selling lemonade. My friends were the ringmaster. And then I had, and once again, returning to the theme of being an only child, I had all of the imagination in the world available to me. My parents were really, really supportive all the time. And my dad had a four-string tenor guitar, which I thought was just a big ukulele as I grew up, but then discovered that it could be tuned like a ukulele. And that's really where I began loving making music. Yeah.
And did you take any lessons? How did you ultimately become a performer and more of a rock and roll performer?
Well, you know, I'm 14, 15 years old. How can you not be a rock and roll performer? That's what you're hearing, you know. I mean, you want to be kind of hip. So, but I'll tell you, hip was not Elvis Presley to me, who I just tried to imitate there. Hip was the Pontiac African-American record store, because it was rhythm and blues. It was the doo-wop. It was the street music that really got to me. And we had a group in high school called the Birds of Paradise. We wrote our own theme song, The Birds of Paradise Doo-Wah are here to say hello, doo-doo-wah. The only way they know doo-doo-wah is with the song. There were five of us, drummer, bass player, and three singers, and my guitar. And we were busy. We put out an album. I mean, that was unheard of for a high school group in 1955. We pressed our own album and sold it in the high school with some original songs that are still embarrassing to me when I hear them done. Yeah.
So you graduate from high school. What's the next step?
Well, I had a job, part-time job in a camera shop in Birmingham, Michigan. And I made movies with my friends in Birmingham. This was after the move to Michigan. And took that knowledge with me to New York. But I'll tell you, I don't know how many times in your life, Bob, you have walked in through the door expecting one kind of response, received another, and then recognized it was, hey, that's a heck of a lot better the response than the one I was expecting. I answered an ad in the New York Times for what I thought would be a camera shop job. And it turned out the guy said, I'm sorry. He said, you're applying for your experience is all in a camera shop. This is for a photocopier job. And I went, selling photocopier machines. I went, oh, he said, but wait just a minute. And he walked into the back room, and it turns out that this was the beginning of Unibath, which was a single chemical process for the three stages that are usually required to process negatives from photographic film. And we worked with the Jet Propulsion Lab. Well, anyway, I got the job, worked with the Jet Propulsion Lab, and went down to the village to play chess one day, and or one night with some friends in the business. And the table was gone where we usually played chess. And they were constructing a stage. I said, what's going on? And he said, oh, we're going to have entertainment here in the village, which was pretty new in 1969. I mean, there were poets that stood up, but there were no stages. And I said, well, what do you have to do to entertain here? Remembering that I was a nascent rock and roll star. He said, well, come down and audition. So in my three-piece Brooks Brothers suit, I went down to Greenwich Village and did the Mickey Mouse song as a rock and roll tune.
And like M-I-C-K-E-Y?
You got it. Who's the leader, doo-doo-wah, of the band? Anyway, they thought I was weird enough. that they hired me, and one thing led to another. I always loved Jonathan Winters, you know, the sound effects. I was doing sound effects in high school. The moment I realized I could abuse a microphone for fun and profit, I went for it. So I was doing traffic noises, and probably the most famous sound effect that I did in the village was the American Standard, which I would introduce as a song and then do the flush of a toilet.
Can you still do that?
Yes, I can, but I don't know if this mic will let me. It was, I did get the handle. I went, and then.
Very good. Very good. Okay. So you're a jack of all trades down there in the village.
I was. And I was a good, I think I was a good choice for that. I was everything from a maitre d' to a comedian to a songwriter to the master of ceremonies. Because no serious artist actually wanted to get up and introduce another artist. I mean, they might do it as a tail end to their performance, but they didn't want to do it as a constant. But I was fine with that because of my, my predilection for wanting to make nice. So when Albert Grossman came in and said, have you ever thought of being in a group? Albert Grossman going on to become the manager of Dylan, Jimmy, of Janis Ian, the band. I said, well, no, I got a few things I want to do by myself. Evidently, at the result of that meeting, he went back to Peter and said, well, he said no, but I think he will. I guess that's what made Albert what Albert was. And he was right. The turning point came in Mary's apartment after about 5 months of rehearsal, where we had come up with about 6 tunes, on the supposition that maybe if Albert liked them, we could be in a group. And the words out of Albert were, well, have you thought about a name for the group? And yeah, and we said, yeah, we've been thinking about the Willows. And he said, well, how about if Noel changes his name, we could call the group Peter, Paul, and Mary. Well, I don't know if you're familiar with a song called The 10,000-Year-Old Man.
I know you're talking about the comedy routine.
No. I'm talking about the song, the folk song. I was born about 10,000 years ago.
Actually, I don't know it.
Okay. Well, I'll give you a little verse. And there's nothing in this world that I don't know. Get ready. Here comes the alliteration. I saw Peter, Paul, and Oses playing Ring Around the Roses, and I'll whoop the guy that says it isn't so. It's a cute song. Talks about the development of world history, but the Peter, Paul, and was already there on our lips, but I recognized, oh my gosh, I'm not going to be a Cary Wisenowski, you know, known as Cary Grant later or whatever. I want to hang on to my name. But then it occurred to me, I never did like my middle name of Carol. So I'll tell you what, I'll take it on as a middle name, not knowing that my middle name was going to take me on and take me out, because from there on, there's a funny thing that happens when you get interviewed. You know, somebody sits down and says, so tell me, Paul. Now, they've already assumed something about you, which for most people would not be a handicap. But for me, I wanted to defend the fact that Noel was my first name. But it became immediately obvious that the question they were asking me was more important than straightening them out as to what my first name was. So Paul took me over for about 10 or 12 years. Then after the spiritual change and having my own life, when Peter, Paul, and Mary took 7 years off for good behavior between 1970 and 1978, when I came back to the group, I said, okay, let's use my full name now. I'm Noel Paul Stuckey, however you want to couch that. That's who I am. That's fine, but I need to have my first name happening. So,
Okay, we jumped through a few things there. You're there, you change the name. Tell us about the agreement for Albert to actually manage you, how you selected the initial songs, how you got a record deal, and what happened there.
Wow. Okay, well, down in the weeds a little bit more. Albert was handling Peter as a solo artist and felt that Peter's voice deserved a better setting. So he wanted to create a group. The first member of the group that he thought of was Mary Travers, whose picture was hanging up on the wall. Peter said, "Who's that?" In Izzy Young's Folklore Center in Greenwich Village. And Albert looked up and knew who she was because she had sung with the Harry Belafonte singers and Pete Seeger, the Song Swappers. And he said, "That's Mary Travers." He said, "She'd be good if you could get her to work." And we, to this day, Mary passed away in 2009, but to this day, Peter and I still don't know if what Albert meant was if you can get her to focus, or if he meant if you could, because she has a small child, she would consider going into, a career. But nonetheless, she was already on board. I had already declined working in a group because I had some things I wanted to do by myself. And I was commuting to Boston to sing up at Club 47 in between Joan Baez and Tom Rush appearances up there. And Betty, my wife, had moved to Boston, so we saw each other up there. And that was another reason for me to find a job up there. But anyway, I'm back in the apartment in New York. It's midweek. The phone rings, and it's Mary on the phone, and she says, "I've got this guy over here who's visiting, and we're wondering if we can come over and sing some songs." Well, you put it like that. Okay. So I had worked up a solo tune for Mary to sing, a Single Girl, which eventually made it on a record, actually. And Single Girl is sort of symbolic of the way that the tunes came to the trio in the beginning. I'd say at least half of our repertoire was drawn on folk music's history, whether they were gospel tunes, whether they were tunes by Pete Seeger or Woody Guthrie, or whether they were songs like The Golden Vanity, that had been in the folk ballad lexicon for, 100 years. But we could not agree, and this is a wonderful moment. We're in my apartment, Peter, Mary, and I, and I know by this time that Peter's represented by Albert, and we want to see if we could sing together. And we're not related. We ain't no Everly brothers, so we don't have that familial vibe that occurs when people of the same family and genetic background make harmonies. So we're kind of fishing around, but every song we come up with, everybody's got a different version of. Such was the way of folk music in the late 50s, early 60s, until we landed on "Mary Had a Little Lamb, Little Lamb." So first, Mary took the melody, Peter and I sang harmony. Then Peter took the melody, Mary and I sang harmony. Then I took the melody, Peter and Mary sang harmony. And no matter which way we sliced or diced it, it sounded like a group. There was and I was just looking, it's funny, timing is everything. And I was just watching an old video of Mary singing the other day. What was it? "Light One Candle" that Peter had written. And we sang, we didn't have to modulate for the woman to sing. We didn't have to change to another key, as sometimes is often done for choruses. Mary's vocal range was quite wide, as was mine, as was Peter's. So we were able to make a sound that we would trade leads all the time. And isn't it curious in retrospect, talking about walking in through the door expecting one thing and leaving with another, that we were named Peter, Paul, and Mary, which meant the three individuals who lent their voices to each other for performances also had these moments in the sun where they would come out and do solo performances. Peter would sing two songs, bring me out. I would do some comedy, sing a song. I'd bring Mary out. She'd do two songs, then the group would reassemble to finish the concert. So there was a kind of continuity, and it showed up not only in, as the group went on, not only in song selection, but the way that our harmonies came together. They were not traditional harmonies. That is to say, we could sing, pronouncing the words at the same time, but we more and more began to fall into the gospel kind of shout and answer, you know, where one would sing a lead and we, Mary and I, might answer Peter. Or Peter was beautiful at creating alternative counter melodies. Sometimes it got to the point where we would write a whole other song and then lay that in against a traditional song. So we kept each other interested in what we were doing by virtue of bringing our individual choices and surprising each other with our song selections. And then Peter and I, as the mid-60s came, began to create more and more original material. So that's...
Okay.
Yeah.
Would the group have been as successful if Albert was not the manager?
Probably not. Albert had a philosophy that was quite righteous in nature. It was a little bit of concealment because Albert was a great, Albert had great taste. And so he knew the value of things before other people could see the value of things. So when he went to Warner Brothers, for instance, who were at that point, the Warner Brothers Records was housed in a Quonset hut on the Burbank lots, the film lots. And I think they had maybe Bill Cosby and Bob Newhart. That was about it. Oh, and they had the Everlys, I think. But they were looking for new material. But they weren't willing to go, they weren't willing to let the artist control their own material. They wanted to dictate what the songs were. They wanted to assign a producer. Albert said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'll tell you what, though. You give us a single record deal, just one record. We don't need three records. You know, we're not going to sign a long deal. Just give us one record and the right to do whatever we want and the budget for that, and then we'll see where it goes from there. Well, needless to say, the first album went through the roof. Peter, Paul, and Mary were established. We had Lemon Tree. We had If I Had a Hammer. The music suited the times. But to put a capper on the description of Albert, his capacity to recognize the value of what he had to bargain with was kind of an invisible leverage. That is to say, he would go to a promoter and say, we would like to do the London Palladium. Or we would like to do Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. And the promoters say, well, you know, I can't give you a $10,000 guarantee. And Albert said, oh, no. We don't want a guarantee. We just want 80% of the ticket sales. So he was always on the come, not on the take. So he got a reputation for being a hard-nosed businessman, but actually he just had great faith in what he thought was a coming attraction. So, you know, an 80% turned out to be $24,000. Who needed the guarantee? And that, you know, I'm just making those numbers up, but relatively you understand what I'm saying. He was able to negotiate great terms for us no matter where we went, and he was our manager for the first 10, 11 years of our lives. And probably the greatest coup that he pulled off was when the trio recorded their individual solo albums in the early 70s, he negotiated that those records, those tapes, those master tapes, would revert to the artists as their property, that Warner Brothers was only leasing them. And so both Peter, Mary, and myself had those records as our own property. They came back to us. Albert was pretty amazing guy. And what a, it's very ironic, being the culinary artiste You know, he really understood good food. Had a restaurant in Woodstock called The Bear. And how ironic that he should die on an airplane headed for London. And the first question that most people had was, before or after the meal? He was a delightful man with a great giggle. That's what I remember most about Albert. He used to go, he would never laugh out loud. He would go. Yeah.
Okay. Now, Dylan ultimately fell out with him over money. I would ask, A, what percentage did he take? And do you feel comfortable with the deal and how things, the financial accountings?
Well, for us, mind you, Albert put us together. So the fact that he and his office took 15% was absolutely proper as far as we were concerned. Not only that, the success of the group was so large and so immediate that, I think we would have had to develop some kind of animosity much, much later, you know, maybe when the money was running out or our career had turned south, which it never did. We did leave Albert after the time off for good behavior, but he had so many other irons in the fire by that time. He really didn't need us anymore. And I think Bobby's falling out with Albert was more a question of the publishing than it was
yes.
how Albert was handling his career.
Okay, so how did you decide to do the first hit was If I Had a Hammer. So how did you decide to do that?
No. First hit was Lemon Tree.
Oh, right.
Lemon Tree was on, it was just on the Peter Paul and Mary album, and Buck Herring, a young DJ out of Oakland, can't remember the KFEW, KBE, I don't know what the radio station was. Anyway, he pulled it off, made it the single of the week or something. Couple of other radio stations picked up on it. And, you know, the charts were intimate then. I mean, Billboard and Cashbox, they were the only charts around. Maybe Bill Gavin's report. And so people would see, what? Lemon Tree, what is that? Who are these people? Give me that album. Let me hear that. And so we were top 30 with Lemon Tree. Well, you know, fame, acceptance is quite often built on a previous record. And certainly it was in this case. And though Lemon Tree was not a political statement, it certainly set up the visibility of the group so that in 1962, 63, when the foment about civil rights was happening, If I Had a Hammer was, became a calling card. Its timing was expressive of a lot of the sentiment that was felt across the country. And, you know, we were the right people at the right time with the right message. And following that, to be able to, because of Albert's handling of Dylan and the opportunity to hear Dylan's tunes before anybody else heard them, when we heard Don't Think Twice and Blowing in the Wind one night backstage at the Gate of Horn in Chicago, we wanted to do both the tunes. And as you well know, Blowing in the Wind not only became a number two hit following If I Had a Hammer, but also has gone on to become a classic done by, you know, tons of performers and always has a certain resonance among those people who still fight for human rights world around.
Okay, so when you say you heard it backstage, on an acetate, or was mm-hmm. Bob himself there? Was going on?
No. On an acetate, yeah. Now, most people don't know what an acetate is, you know. That's like a vinyl gone early. It requires a needle on cutting a groove. And as the sound comes out, the groove moves sideways and up and down, lateral and vertical, and then when you put a needle on that and play it back through an amplified process, you get what was recorded. So yes, it was an acetate played on a turntable at the bar at the Gate of Horn.
But Albert was managing Dylan. So was it just a matter of him feeding you these songs, or was it a whole cabal with Albert and his acts that you were in it together and you had a relationship with Dylan, you were same scene, or were you really in different verticals?
That's interesting. You probably believe a lot of other conspiracy theories too, right?
Oh, believe me, I'm the opposite of a conspiracy theorist.
Oh, you are? Okay. Well, okay. No, there was no conspiracy involved. There was just a, a parallel of themes. You know, I mean, like I said, these are the times in which we lived. And, you know, my first contact with Bobby as a passing artist was when I was master of ceremonies in Greenwich Village, and Bobby came in to do a set. And he, at that time, the first time through the Gaslight, he sang mostly Woody Guthrie tunes. And he had a voice very much that suited Woody Guthrie tunes. And then he went away to go on tour, I think it was in New Jersey. And he came back maybe a couple of months later and asked if he could do a set. And I, kind of being in charge of the entertainment, I said, yeah, sure, of course. And he got up on stage and he did a song about Buffalo. Can't remember what, it's not Buffalo Riders, Buffalo, I don't know. It was a song about a guy that gets a job out in the West, skinning buffalo, buffalo skinner. That's what it was. But these were totally different lyrics. The original lyric was about how the buffalo skinner goes to get paid and they give him skins. And he says, well, I can't do anything with this. I got to eat. And the guy says, take it to the general store and trade in the skins and he'll give you the food. Oh, so that's, this is told to a plaintive three chord folk melody, right? That's the traditional tune. Dylan comes back from 2 months in New Jersey singing at a folk club. And he starts playing the chords behind Buffalo Skinner, only he's talking about a guy that's gone to work at this chess folk club in New Jersey. That's what the lyric is about. And the fact that when he comes to get his payroll, the owner of the chess club gives him a chess set instead of money. And he says, what am I supposed to do with this? And he says, take it to the bartender. So he goes to the bar and he orders a beer and he pays him a king and gets two pawns and a rook in return. Now, the moment I saw that, you know, I mean, that was a revelation to me. Here was somebody who understood in a more significant level the abstract of folk music, that it had the capacity to inform, tell a story, but that it was timeless, that the arrangement was conceivably just an opportunity to voice more contemporary concerns. So 2 days later, I don't know if you remember, but a ferry runs aground in New York Harbor, in the Hudson River, because counterfeit tickets were printed for a Bear Mountain picnic. And too many people got on board the ship. They refused to believe that they were counterfeit and the ship sank. And the irony of that was not lost on the person who wrote the news article. And I handed the article to Dylan, who was there for the weekend. The next night, he came in and does the Talking Bear Mountain Picnic Massacre Blues. So 2 days later, or thereabouts, I say to Albert, you got to come down and hear this guy. He is a genius. So that was Albert's, I think, first contact with Dylan, or first awareness of Dylan. But they were a great couple. I mean, Dylan moved right into Woodstock, and what a great synergy between him and Robbie and the band. I mean, what a great, great group of musicians and thinkers. And the Basement Tapes are just so lovely. An inspiration, once again, for being authentic, you know, find the best way in your own voice to speak to that which concerns you, and you'll include a lot of people, because I think people can, they just sense the truth. It's like what Richard Nixon was not.
Okay, let's go back to that era. I'm old enough to be aware most people only read about it in books, but prior to the Beatles, there was a huge folk scene, even to the point there was a TV show, Hootenanny.
Yeah, right.
You've referenced the fact that there was a scene in Greenwich Village. Once again, legendary, but it was happening when most people were not aware. Needless to say, with your success, you were kings and queen of that scene. What was it like in the folk world at that time?
Well, don't forget, speaking of kings, the Kingston Trio, who were out the door early, maybe 2 years prior to us, with folk music. But it was kind of good time folk music. It was, you know, let's all get together and have a great time singing together. Let's have a couple of beers. Let's have a party. Let's sing Waltzing Matilda. Let's sing, you know, songs that we all know. Well, that was good, but this was a different kind of music. And so the folk scene sort of changed, bent in that direction and augured for a more concerned lyric in general. Now the folk scene itself, okay, I mean, there was the Kingstons, there was John Stewart, who brought arguably to the Kingstons a kind of political conscience that they hadn't had since Dave Gard left the group. There was the Brandywine Singers, there was, you know, the Brothers Four, there were, you know, and Judy. And then there were the soloists. I mean, there was Joni, there was Judy Collins, there was... you know, the mind cannot really, I can't fully embrace the breadth. It was just such a wide variety of artists who little by little made their statements through the medium of folk music, and folk music began to have its effect on pop music because here were DJs, you know, that were used to playing lush ballads by Burt Bacharach, and now they were playing a guitar and a harmonica and a guy singing. What is this? Well, you know, where's the luster? Where's the glamour? And eventually that desire for a more a more arresting sound began to manifest itself in rock and roll, and the lyrics subsequently were inspired in rock and roll. You know, I Can't Get No Satisfaction, in a sense, was a far cry from what the world needs now is love, sweet love.
Yeah.
So folk music's impact on pop music in the mid-60s triggered the release of a variety. To me, one of the main changes occurred when James Taylor came on the scene, because his ability to blend a beautifully played acoustic guitar with piano, drums, kind of was the middle ground. You know, once again, we could have pretty music that spoke to very personal relations that had a broader conscience to it. And then, of course, the Beatles arrived with Please Please Me, and the Stones continued, and then we were into the Loving Spoonful, and even to this day, as a matter of fact, I'm holding up, your people can't see it, but I'm holding up an album that says Hope Rises. This is a album that contains 15 new artists, because a lot of people, and I'm sure it's something that you will ask later in this interview, where can we hear music that pertains to the times and the crises in which we live now? And that music is there, but the niche for its expression has narrowed considerably. I mean, there are many slices of opportunity now. And what Music to Life does, has done, is to sponsor these artists in their separate communities and to encourage them to record and to use music as part of the everyday outreach to their communities. But we'll talk about that later. Anyway, the fact that I brought it up is part of the awareness that styles of music have less to do with the success of the lyric than they used to. You know, there was a time when country and Western was hillbilly. You know, there was a time when hip hop and rap was nothing but anger. There was a time, you know, when bossa nova was a lush rather than pointed. So these changes, I think, came about to a large part because they were encouraged by folk music's encouragement to speak to those events that we share as a world community.
But, you know, from the outside, not being a maker of this music, what do I know? Everyone, wherever you went, there was a guitar and you sang these songs. They were sung at summer camps, etc. And in addition, there was a lot of, you know, even when Kennedy was there, there were a lot of political issues, certainly starting with what was going on in Cuba. It seemed from the outside that the folk artists had their finger on the pulse and were singing to move sentiment in a certain direction. Did it feel like that on the inside?
Oh, yeah. I mean, by 1963, for sure. Standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial with Dr. King. I've referred to it many times. You know, Mary turned to Peter and said, hope is palpable.
Okay, that begs the question, I got to say, although Obama ran on hope, you know, a number of years ago, 2008, as someone who's seen it all, contrast, I don't want to make it sound like a college question, contrast and compare, the vibe in the American mentality then as opposed to today.
I think there was some resistance to the human rights movement, particularly as it presented itself in the as a challenge to the white racists in the South, and that it wasn't. But the overall effectiveness of that movement, of the civil rights movement, was that it expressed a desire for America to get righteous. To be inclusive, as its history has indicated it was. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free. This was a chance to go on public record as the encouragement. And that then morphed into, oh, I see, we can, as a large group, get together and if not influence people's opinions, we can at least express our own in numbers that would encourage them to discover what the true facts behind this are. And so that's when it morphed into the anti-war movement. It was a natural chain of events, I think. It, in a sense, empowered large groups of people to make statements. And the music was a thread that ran through all of that.
Okay, but today, do you believe that we are off course or we can always self-correct and have hope? And where is music's place in today's consciousness?
Well, you know, you're talking to Mr. Hopeful here. I mean, I am loath to despair. I mean, I see inequities still, but I know that in my own life, I've seen change, so I can't help but feel that everybody's life has the possibility to change. And I know that we're at loggerheads conceptually with many of the people who back Donald Trump. But I can't help but feel that when we discover the larger issue, and that is one of respect and compassion, we will ultimately be joined again. Now, you can't legislate compassion. You can only invite it by being compassionate yourself. You can't legislate forgiveness. But, you know, taking a page out of Mandela's handling of apartheid, you can have public forums where people voice their concerns and are, if not assuaged, at least aware that reconciliation is possible because every human life has value. So the hope that we will begin to consider the larger inspiration for the human experience. It goes on. That's why, you know, the song I sang to you before about love with a capital L, that is the awareness. Sure, the atheist will not accept the G word, you know, but if they've ever been in love, then they have an inkling of what it is that can draw us together. And that means that, you know, the better angels in us begins to embrace and include our fellow human beings. I think town halls, you know, actually are going to become a very important aspect, because on a local level, they will allow us to voice concerns that relate directly to our lives. And then we're going to be able to translate that into a larger picture.
Okay, let's go back to the 60s in our timeline. The Beatles come along. They wipe out a zillion acts. Very few sustain, okay? The Beach Boys sustain. The Four Seasons sustain. But ultimately, Peter, Paul, and Mary end up having a couple of gigantic hits. One is I Dig Rock and Roll Music. Can you tell us the story of that?
Yeah. Yeah. I got a great friend. I think I mentioned him earlier, Jim Mason, who produced a couple of things for Poco. I was introduced to him by Dave Dixon, who was the voice of Norman Normal in a cartoon that I did for Warner Brothers. Jim Mason came in, sat down in the living room of Dave Dixon's living room, where we used to, in New York City on Jane Street, and said, I got a new tune for you. And he sang with the most inane lyrics you've ever heard in your life about my girl. She left me on a Thursday and I wonder if she ever cared, you know, that kind of thing. And when it got all done, I looked at Jim and I said, that's the hippest piece of music to the most banal lyrics I've ever heard in my life. And he said, well, what do you think it's about? And so between the three of us, we started writing I Dig Rock and Roll Music. Now, we just went through this period of time where I did my toilet for you and a couple of sound effects. So I love to mimic. We knew all the people that we were mimicking. By this time, we had Peter, Mary, and I had met the Beatles on the set of Hard Day's Night. Ever since Please Please Me, I was blown away by their harmonic inventions and their recordings. You know, and Donovan, bless his soul, was part folky too. I mean, he came to a couple of Newport folk festivals and was the one guy from that era who always, I don't know, our paths seemed to cross all the time. And nicest man, but with a very distinctive singing style. And of course, there was the Mamas and the Papas. Oh, yeah. The John Philip signature stuff. And Mary knew Cass really well. And so we put this thing together almost like in secret. I mean, it was like we went into the laboratory. Peter played guitar and recorded it backwards. So we get that, you know, that backwards sound. I imitated Donovan's voice. We did Mary did the, oh, yeah. The tagline for the Mamas and the Papas. And you know, here's the funny story. We're in Australia when the test pressing comes through. Well, we don't have any way to play a test pressing. We're in a hotel, you know? So we go to the local record store and we put it on and we ask if we can borrow one of the booths. And the guy says, yeah, I'll just leave the door open. So we left the door open, we play it. And he says to us, who's that? Who's that singing? And we said, it's Peter, Paul, and Mary, because he didn't recognize us. And he said, well, that'll never sell. So that was a remarkable comeback. But that's not the true irony. The true irony is leaving on a jet plane, which happened in 1970, just before the group took its 7 years off for good behavior. And that irony was based on the the lament and the angst that was shared by so many families, their sons and their daughters, and the soldiers returning to or departing for the war in Vietnam. John Denver's tune was just touched so many buttons at that point. And that tune was on an album that was released 2 years earlier that had I Dig Rock and Roll music on it.
Well, I remember that because, you know, in youth groups, religious youth groups, myself, I was involved. Album 1700 was a big deal. We always sang Leaving on a Jet Plane. Then what is ultimately a hit was such a surprise. Mm. But I have to ask, those of us who remember, it was called Album 1700 because it was number 1700 in the Warner Brothers catalog. Who came up with that?
Our idea was to try to escape the title. And we just wanted the number of the album to be the title. And we were thinking it was going to be like 1647 or, you know, 2012 or whatever. We didn't care. We just wanted, that was our idea. That was Peter, Mary, and I said, let's just have the number. We told that to Warners. Warner said, fine. So when 1700 came out, we said, 1700? That's an even number. What's so memorable about that? And you got the word album in front of it. We didn't want that. But it turned out not to matter because 1700 had really quite a few major turning point tunes for us. By that time, Peter and I were generating a lot of the material. I don't remember what was on that album specifically besides I Dig Rock and Roll Music, but I think it might have had The Songless Love. It might have had Him. It might have had... might have had the house song on it. Those were mine. I think The Great Mandela was on it. Peter's anti-war tune. Yeah, that was and it was the last of the albums done by Phil Ramone, who was a production genius. He did come back and do a album that disappeared quickly called Reunion. Not the Reunion album. He did the one after that, Lifelines Live. Lifelines and Lifelines Live, where we reconnected in the early 80s with John Sebastian and Dave Van Ronk and Odetta and Richie Havens and Susan Werner, a lot of our friends, Emmylou Harris, to do an album of songs.
Okay, tell me the story, though, of Too Much of Nothing. Because that was on the Basement Tapes and was unknown. The Basement Tapes album, there have been a number of iterations, but the original double album was not out yet. So most people did not know the song. And not only was it a Dylan song, the ultimate arrangement was different, and it had very modern recording production sound. Mm.
Yep. Well, you know, we got better at setting the tunes, and we also had access to really brilliant musicians. That slide guitar in Too Much of Nothing is just me. I mean, there is always an attempt when you're producing a piece of lyrical music to have the music join the lyric, as an additive. To be part of what's being said, to not only suit the mood, but maybe even embellish the character a little bit. Sometimes it gets out of hand, you overshoot. I can remember there are some times where I used to play some color chords to a Woody Guthrie tune. By color chords, I mean like a major seventh, you know, or diminished or something, and Peter would go, "You can't play that." I said, "Why not?" He said, "That's not what the song is about." And you understand on a certain level, you have to capitulate to what the song is trying to say. But on Too Much of Nothing, you know, the embellishment really suited it. We had a great drummer. I don't remember what his name was, but Too Much of Nothing can make a man feel ill at ease. And that certainly is the time in which we live now, isn't it?
That's for sure. Okay. Now, ultimately, the group separates and everybody puts out a solo album. Mm. You're the only one who has a hit, and it's a pretty big hit, The Wedding Song. Mm. And then ultimately, you even donate the income from that song and start a foundation. Can you tell us all of that?
Yeah. Well, the creation of the song was I had gone through a real spiritual turnaround. Peter saw that. We are still a trio, but it's getting a little wobbly because I'm beginning to proselytize on stage and really challenging the Jewish audience because I haven't learned the language of inclusiveness yet. And yet Peter approaches me and says, you know, Mary Beth and I are getting married and we would love you to bless our wedding with a song. And I've said this from stage before, you know, I knew that I wasn't authorized to dispense blessings, but I knew where I could get one. So I prayed for the song and the prayer was unique insofar as it was not give me a song for Peter's wedding. It was, how would you, capital Y, manifest yourself at Peter's wedding? And the lyric was, I am now to be among you at the calling of your hearts. Rest assured, this bozo, which I changed to troubadour, is acting is acting on my part. Anyway, the lyric came so quickly, I could barely write it down. And you've heard these stories from other songwriters before where it just flows. But it was direct answer to prayer. So flash forward 9 months later, I've recorded it on a solo album. The trio is no longer together. And I am driving to New York, back to the Rye House from Scarsdale. I can't remember. Maybe we were visiting somebody in New Hampshire. But anyway, I've got to make a decision about publishing. Every one of the tunes has got, I'm doing a tune by Bill Hughes called Meanings Will Change. I've written a lot of the tunes that are on the album, but there's this tune that I can't really credibly accept the authorship of because I prayed for it. I mean, if they had a category in songwriting that said good steward, maybe I'll qualify, but they don't allow that in publishing. You either wrote it or you didn't write it. So as I'm driving, I turn to Betty and I say, I'm going to give this tune to a foundation. And then, so that way the monies will still come in. There won't be a new Porsche in the Warner Brothers parking lot that belongs to some executive because he didn't have to pay out the money for the publishing. The money will go to now, mind you, this is still just a track on an album. I don't know that it's going to go, platinum as a single or become a mainstay for weddings. So I gave it to the Public Domain Foundation, made sure that everybody knew that that's where the money should go. And you know what? The Public Domain Foundation fostered the Music to Life organization, which now supports young singer-songwriters all over America in their various communities. It also, in that process, supported a lot of other charities too. And the nice thing about it, Bob, was I got to choose who the charities were because it was such a homespun foundation. I mean, yeah, I gave, Public Domain Foundation gave $30,000 to Oxfam, which a lot of people know the works of, but it also gave like $41.34 to a church in Alabama to get its roof fixed. That kind of flexibility was just a joy to me. And people didn't know where to apply to the foundation, but the monies went for good causes. And I felt like I had made a statement and the song continues to make a statement.
Okay. You can't talk about the music business without talking about the money. Mm. What do we know? Back then, concert tickets could be $1.50. Records could be $2.50. You didn't write a lot of these songs. Now, on one level, economics were different. There was more of a middle class. We didn't have billionaires. So I guess it's, a multi-part question, which was, A, did you see the money? Could you live with a lifestyle you were comfortable with? Do you feel like you were ripped off? When the heyday was done, was there any money coming in?
Oh, that's such an uninformed question, Bob.
Well, lay it on me. Criticize me. Go for it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Well, let's work backwards. Even today, from Warner Brothers Publishing or New World Publishing, which is my own, or Peter's, I think it's Silver Dawn Publishing, we get accountings. They come in the form of 2-inch thick pieces of paper, a 2-inch stack of papers typed out by a computer that says, for instance, too much of nothing, Singapore, 0.00125 cents. These things add up. And when you're talking about a worldwide release, they add up to a considerable amount of money. So even to this date, I probably, just my part of it, and I'm, you know, I didn't have Puff the Magic Dragon. You know, I didn't have, I would say, the lion's share of the publishing. But even to this date, I'm well into five figures publishing monies that come in quarterly. So I'm just blessed beyond belief, really. And I think most people who had record deals from the 60s who are revisited for nostalgia purposes or revisited because an advertising campaign wants to use their music, the ASCAP and AFTRA and all of the unions that have protected artists these past years have done their work very well. And to the extent that you earn in royalty, you get a pretty fair shake from the world around you. So I have no complaints, no quarrel with the way that the monies were played out. There probably are horror stories based on unscrupulous managers, you know, or unscrupulous companies who had you sign on a dotted line in invisible ink that went away or went through a shredder or into some offshore account. But for the most part, the people that we dealt with were very upright, very honorable folks. And most of the music industry, I think, is that way.
Well, as I say, there's certainly horror stories. Thank God it wasn't down in your neck of the woods. Let's go to the Music to Life. When did you start Music to Life, and what is the mission you sort of generally said, and what are the activities of the organization?
Thanks for asking, because that is a contemporary thing, and most people like to dwell in the land of nostalgia when they talk to a former member of Peter, Paul, and Mary. The fact is, as I mentioned before, folk music has an ongoing life, and that means that there are writers, singer-songwriters out there who are writing about contemporary events, contemporary concerns, and they are a group of songwriters nationally and probably even worldwide now that an organization called Music to Life that was begun by my daughter, Elizabeth Sunday Stuckey, support. But the evolution is interesting. And it's interesting because most people can identify with the beginnings easier than they can with where it has come. In the beginning, there were folk festivals. And at these folk festivals, there would be singer-songwriters. One of the primary folk festivals was in Texas, in the little town called Kerrville. And every year, beginning in the late 1900s, Elizabeth, my daughter, and I would scan anywhere between 300 and 500 applicants to be included on an album called Music to Life and appear at the Silverthorne Theater as one of 10 finalists who would receive awards. Those were curious concerts beginning then. First of all, they were recorded live and released later as an album. But
what year are we
this
in?
This is 1998 in the beginning, but it went on until 2006, 2009. Actually, I think it was the last one. And they supported and encouraged singer-songwriters to speak about contemporary concerns. It was recorded live. The CD was released, didn't really make much money, but was great to go on record as having encouraged these singer-songwriters. Well, over the course of that period of time, my daughter Liz began to understand that many of these artists didn't do the music just because it was a hip thing to do. They did it because they were factoring as a lifestyle into their community and concerned with homelessness, concerned with the environment, concerned with. So the music wasn't only to be sung at a rubber chicken benefit dinner. It was actually could be used with a group of people as a kind of an anthem for them. So by community sponsorship, they, for instance, in Austin, Texas now, there's a homeless group that gathers weekly and they make up songs together. They sing together. They have more of a sense of family than they ever could, isolated as you would imagine they would be. They're singing in prisons now. So that music becomes kind of educational and a collective tool for the movement itself. And to that end, my daughter Liz has started the Activist Artists Program, which these two of the people on this album are activist artists. The others are still in the point where they're commenting on the circumstances, but not taking a role in the community yet. So we raise money, we mentor them. One of the local guys, Miles Bullen down in Portland, Maine, it was a former addict, and we support him on a monthly basis. And he deals with high schools. I mean, he has to do it because of the pandemic now, through Zoom or through online methods, but we support these artists and their involvement in their neighborhoods as they bring their message of hope and their, as they bring their message of hope through music to their fellow citizens.
Okay, now you recently put out an album, and how hands-on are you personally?
That's a good question, and it brings to mind the fact that I didn't properly answer the question about the earlier aspect of who chose these songs to go on this album out of the 300 to 500 tunes. That was a great cast of Kathy Mattea, Judy Collins, Tom Chapin, Tom Paxton. A lot of the folkies served on a board that analyzed and listened to these tunes. So this same concept now came to bear on these 15 tunes. My involvement, aside from being one of the judges, was to sequence. I'm from the old school. I'll bet you are too. When I put a record on, I love to hear what the next tune is going to be. I mean, it's part of what makes radio so fascinating. If the disc jockey is really good, then he tells a story with the songs that he tends to program. So sequencing was important to me on this album, Hope Rises. That was probably my major contribution. The fact is, I would say fully a dozen of the 15 tunes were selected just by quantitatively saying this song spoke to me on a scale of 0 to 10. This was a 9, or this was an 8.5, or this was a. But three of the songs, and I can't remember which ones they are, but three of the songs are on the album because, well, they damn well should be. It was one of those, okay, everybody gets a personal vote at some point. You get to, it's the opposite of a veto. It's a must have. So it was mostly a democratic process that brought the songs together. But there's a great deal of excitement. And you know what really knocks me out? These are 15 very diverse artists. I mean, we're talking hip hop, we're talking reggae, we're talking, we're talking folky, we're talking lots of echo, we're talking no echo, we're talking spare, we're talking lush. And I'd like to claim credit that because of the sequencing, you're drawn into it. But the nicest compliment that we've gotten so far is that people can put on the record and they can play the entire record and they're not put off by any of the changes. I mean, as diverse as all of these tracks are, they flow one to another. Now, one's got to secretly hope that the reason for that is because the intention is selling the tune, that the caring that these artists have is being expressed in a way that's subliminal, and you just can't help but warmly respond to it.
Now, needless to say, the landscape in society, in the music world, is completely different from when you guys came up in the early 60s. So when we talk about this type of music, I'll use labels which, you know, don't really nail it, but message music, music that might, you know, reflect society or want to push it into a certain degree. Mm. Many people who've been around felt that we'd see a surge of this music after the surge when we had Iraq war in the early part of the century. But what we know is that no specific social commentary, anti-war political song has come top of mind in society. So I must ask you, is that a matter of the breadth of music today in that it's almost hard to have anything heard by everybody? Or are we lacking the one specific writer or artist who will make something definitive and then start a new movement?
I think both of those possibilities are true. For instance, I will remind you of Bruce Springsteen and his important position in bringing to the public mind issues and perspectives on the way that we live our lives together. Whether he enacted it through his, you know, 10,000 people in an arena, or whether he does it on Broadway. So, and Lady Gaga, you know, to a certain extent, but these, Lady Gaga is perhaps more niche in terms of what she is expressing. But nonetheless, so that's why the other possibility that you introduced is also correct. There are just so many fragments of musical opportunity that exist now for artists that they have to pick their particular community to speak to. There is not going to be one. I mean, unless the Messiah is going to arrive and be accompanied by a 12-piece band and bring a whole different kind of music that everybody immediately recognizes as the answer to all of the foibles of humankind, that's not going to happen in the way that we were able to accept music of the civil rights movement, music of the anti-apartheid movement, music of the environmental movement. I mean, these are, they're bigger than splinters. They're probably even planks, but they're not an entire house.
Interesting metaphor. Okay. Just to cover one thing before, because we're going to have to wrap it up, you have to go, and we've gone at length. Do you ever get tired of singing these legendary songs?
I do have a little trouble with Puff the Magic Dragon. Though, you know, sometimes just in defense of the poor dragon who's maligned for his apparent or alleged association with drugs, I don't mind standing up for the poor little guy, you know, and setting the record straight that he is really just a song about a kid who's coming of age. Tom Paxton had a great line for this, Bob. He said, it's all right to look at the past. You just don't want to be caught staring at it. And to the extent that I'm still writing new tunes and embracing tunes by other artists that speak to the here and now, I feel like it's important to include some songs of the past, but it's also important to register the fact that we are living contemporarily and that there is a possible future before us that has a brighter light than the world that we're living in now.
On that note of optimism, I don't think I can add anything more. Noel, this has been fantastic. You're very erudite, very articulate. You can speak as well as sing. I really appreciate you spending the time.
Bob, I was not looking forward to this at all. 2 hours out of my life was not the kind of thing that I wanted to do. And you are an irascible, wonderful old host who brought the best out of my history. I enjoyed so much this time with you. And once again, to make that analogy, I entered this door with an expectation, and I am leaving with a far greater excitement than I thought I would have. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, to use that old Yiddish expression, I'm kvelling, even though people can't see it on the screen. But, you know, you have to understand, you know, there's a huge thought that today's society, youngsters don't have a sense of history. They talk about baseball players not knowing the people before. But for those of us who live through this era, okay, not only is it a thrill to speak with you, but I am aware, I mean, the folk era has been distilled essentially to Dylan going to Electric on Newport, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, forgetting the whole essence of what was going on. Not that that was not important. But relative to the scene at large, which is much larger, and the fact that you can talk about it and put it in context is certainly thrilling to me. And I'm not exaggerating. It's like, you know, if we had more time, what was it really like? I mean, I grew up only 50 miles away. I'll tell you something that you'll get, which most people won't. And then I was a freshman in high school. And with social studies, we were going to go on a trip, a field trip. And we're deciding where to go. And we were going to go to Sturbridge Village. Mm-hmm, you're aware of Sturbridge Village, sure, right? Yep. That's, you know, just over the line from Connecticut, Massachusetts. It's kind of like Williamsburg, people know better, where it's, you know, a reenactment of the way life used to be. All of a sudden, the guy in the back, Steve Belinke, says, "We can't go there. It's terrible. All the people, it's crowded." And we're all sitting there in class, you know, what is he talking about? Sturbridge Village? And then somebody says, "You mean Greenwich Village." And as I say, it was such a scene, you know, it's funny that, you know, things happen. I wouldn't say right under my nose because I was young at the time and I was not living in the city and I didn't have wheels. But these, you know, scenes fomented and you were right there at the epicenter. Mm. And as I say, once again, you can talk about it, which is very impressive to me. So maybe at a future date, we can go deeper into some of those scenes. But thanks again so much for doing this.
Robert, it was my pleasure. Thank you again. It was really fun.
Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.